up in a seasonal program with a 21-gun salute, and I hear the triumphant booming as the Poetry Center opens its spring program tonight. It has taken us 4 years to persuade Dr. Winters to read for us, and that he has finally consented to do so is, I believe, a tacit acknowledgement that the Poetry Center exists, and that perhaps it has even reached a certain stature. Dr. Winters has asked that he be spared the embarrassment of a eulogistic introduction. I can spare him that, since obviously he needs no introduction at all. Besides, his praises were sung in the highest terms last night over KPFA by Kenneth Rexroth in announcing this program. And you have in your hands statements about his work made by two of his devoted students and friends. And so, ladies and gentlemen, there is nothing more that I need to add, except that the Poetry Center is proud and honored to be able to present Dr. Ivor Winters. Dr. Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I have to buckle on my armor here. I hope you'll bear with me for a moment. I'm not sure how this works. This hall or with this equipment. Would you please let me know, am I reaching the people in the back of the hall? If I am, will a few of you raise your hands? All right. The next question, is this too loud? Is it all right? Fine. The poems that I'm going to read were written from approximately 1928 to 1954. I won't trouble you with individual dates except where they're a part of the title. The first poem is entitled To William Dinsmore Briggs Conducting His Seminar. Mr. Briggs was the chairman of the Department of English at Stanford when I first came there, and one of the three or four most brilliant men I've ever known. Amid the walls insensate white, some crime is redefined above the sunken mass of crumbled years. Logic reclaims the crass, frees from historic dross the invidious mind. Your fingers spin the pages into time, and in between moments of darkness pass like undiscovered instants in the glass. Amid the image where the demons climb, climb and regard and mean, yet not emerge, and in the godless thin electric glare, I watch your face spun momently along, till the dark moments close and wrinkles verge on the definitive and final stare. And that hard book will now contain this wrong. The next poem is called The Fable. This one is written in blank verse. Very short. Beyond the steady rock, the steady sea, in movement more immovable than station, gathers and washes and is gone. It comes, a slow, obscure metonymy of motion, crumbling the inner barriers of the brain. But the crossed rock braces the hills and makes a steady quiet of the steady music, massive with peace. And listen now, the foam receding down the sand silvers between the grains, thin, pure as virgin words, vending machine to nothing, whispering. The next poem is called The Slow Pacific Swell. This is written in iambic pentameter couplets. Far out of sight, forever stands the sea, bounding the land with pale tranquility. When a small child, I watched it from a hill at 30 miles or more. The vision still lies in the eye, soft blue and far away. The rain has washed the dust from April day. Paintbrush and lupin lie against the ground. The wind above the hilltop has the sound of distant water in unbroken sky. Dark and precise the little steamers ply. Firm in direction, they seem not to stir. That is illusion. The artificer of quiet distance holds me in a vise and holds the ocean steady to my eyes. Once, when I rounded flattery, the sea hove its loose weight like sand to tangle me upon the washing deck, to crush the hull. Subsiding dragged flesh at the bone, the skull felt the retreating wash of dreaming hair. Half drenched in dissolution, I lay bare. I scarcely pulled myself erect. I came back slowly, slowly knew myself the same. That was the ocean. From the ship we saw gray whales for miles, the long sweep of the jaw, the blunt head plunging clean above the wave. And one rose in a tent of sea and gave a darkening shudder. Water fell away, the whale stood shining, and then sank in spray. A landsman I, the sea is but a sound. I would be near it on a sandy mound and hear the steady rushing of the deep while I lay stinging in the sand with sleep. I have lived inland long. The land is numb. It stands beneath the feet, and one may come walking securely till the sea extends its limber margin and precision ends. By night, a chaos of commingling power, the whole Pacific hovers hour by hour. The slow Pacific swell stirs on the sand, sleeping to sink away, withdrawing land, heaving and wrinkled in the moon and blind, or gathers seaward, ebbing out of mind. The next poem is called The Journey, Snake River Country. It's in the same verse form. I now remembered slowly how I came, I sometime living, sometime with a name, creeping by iron ways across the bare wastes of Wyoming, turning in despair, changing and turning till the fall of night, then throbbing motionless with iron might. 4 days and nights, small stations by the way, sunk far past midnight. Nothing one can say names the compassion they stir in the heart. Obscure men shift and cry, and we depart. And I remembered with the early sun that foul-mouthed barber back in Pendleton, the sprawling streets, the icy station bench, the roundup penance, the latrinal stench. These towns are cold by day, the flesh of vice raw and decisive, and the will precise. At night, the turbulence of drink and mud, blue glare of gas, the dances dripping blood, fists thudding murder in the shadowy air, exhausted whores sunk to a changeless stare. Alive in empty fact alone, extreme, they make each fact a mortuary dream. Once, when the train paused in an empty place, I met the unmoved landscape face to face, smoothing abysses that no stream could slake. Deep in its black gulch crept the heavy snake. The sound diffused and so intently firm, it seemed the silence having changed nor term. Beyond the river, gray volcanic stone in rolling hills, the river moved alone. And when we started, charged with mass and slow, we hung against it in an awful flow. Thus I proceeded until early night, and when I read the station's name aright, descended at the bidding of a word. I slept the night out where the thought occurred, then rose to view the dwelling where I lay. Outside, the bare land stretching far away, the frame house new, fortuitous and bright, pointing the presence of the morning light. A train's far screaming, clean as shining steel, planing the distance for the gliding heel. Through shrinking frost, autumnal grass uncurled, in naked sunlight on a naked world. The next poem is called Before Disaster, dated winter 1932 and 3. Evening traffic homeward burns, swift and even on the turn. Drifting weight in triple rows, fixed relation and repose. This one edges out and by, inch with steady eye. But should error be increased, mass and moment are released. Matter loosens, flooding blind, levels drivers to its kind. Ranks of nations thus descend, watchful to a stormy end. By a moment's calm beguiled, I have got a wife and child. Fool and scoundrel guide the state. Peace is whore to greed and hate. Nowhere may I turn to flee. Action is security. Treading change with savage heel, we must live or die by steel. The next one is called Heracles, which perhaps calls for a little explanation. I used an ancient, what is a 19th century, anthropological explanation of the Heraclean myth in this thing that I got from Anthon's Classical Dictionary. It's probably quite obsolete among anthropologists now, but it provided me with a good figure of speech for my poem. That is, Heracles, according to Anthon, was a sun god. And it's a fact that the labors of Heracles seem to bear a very close resemblance to the signs of the zodiac. Symbolically, in this poem, Heracles represents the artist. Eurystheus, trembling, called me to the throne. Alcmena's son, heavy with thews and steel, he drove me on my fatal road alone. I went subservient to Hera's will. For when I had had resisted. She had struck out of the sky and spun my wit. I slew my children quicker than a stroke of luck, with motion lighter than my sinews knew. Compelled down ways obscure with analog to force the symbols of the zodiac, bright lion, boundless hydra, fiery dog, I spread them on my arms as on a rack, spread them and broke them in the groaning wood, and yet the centaur stung me from afar, his blood envenomed with the hydra's blood. Thence was I outcast from the earthy war. Nessus, the centaur, with his wineskin full, his branch and thyrsus, and his fleshy grip, her whom he could not force, he yet could gull, and she drank poison from his bearded lip. Older than man, evil with age his life, injustice, direst perfidy, my bane, drove me to win my lover and my wife. By love and justice I at last was slain. The numbered beings of the wheeling track I carried singly to the empty throne, and yet when I had come exhausted back, was forced to wait without the gate alone. Commanded thus to pause before the gate, I felt from my hot breast the tremors pass, white flame dissecting the corrupted state, Eurystheus vibrant in his den of brass. Vibrant with horror, though a jeweled king, lest the heat mounting madness turn my brain for one dry moment, and the palace ring with crystal terror ere I turn again. This stayed me too. My life was not my own, but I my life's. A god I was, not man. Grown absolute, I slew my flesh and bone. Timeless, I knew the zodiac my span. This was my grief, that out of grief I grew, translated as I was from earth at last, from the sad pain that Deianira knew, transmuted slowly in a fiery blast, perfect and moving perfectly, I rayed eternal silence to eternal ends. And Deianira, an imperfect shade, retreats in silence as my arc descends. Now, I will read two poems from a series of three on the subject of Theseus, the second and the third. Then I will abandon Greek mythology. This one is called Theseus and Ariadne. These two are in blank verse. After the mossy night, and the wet stone, the grappling with the wet hair of the beast, after the slow and careful fingering of the pale linen on the cold return, Theseus emerged. Ariadne awaited him, her face half hidden with black hair and shame. And Theseus spoke, "The Minotaur is dead. Pacify the white will sin no more. The daughter of the moon who bore this ghast and dripping horror has been long at rest. The sin of your blood I have extinguished, yet think not you will go quit. Your body is mine by all these tokens, and the taint of hell has eaten through my skin. Minos contrived the trembling blackness of that hall of vision. The prisoned fiend, your brother, beat me down. I drew him after, and his blood burned through me, stinging more wildly than your body. She, my mother's sin, has poisoned you, and I was poisoned long ago. We share this crime, and I am yours, I know not to what end. Minos vengeance is buried in our two bodies. You had me from Minos should you prevail, and Minos is the will of Zeus, withdraws not. I am motionless in the scales of justice. We go now to your ship. The carven wood will glide in quiet from the rocks of Crete, that blood-stained island of the gods, and we shall set our feet in peace on lesser isles. So Theseus took her by the hand, boarded the limber galley, and the foam distended coldly above the crash on rock. The boat, quick on the heavy tumult, scoured the inlets and found that island where he slew her, yet escaped not, took her sister, her for whom Poseidon betrayed him when he slew his son. The next one, the old age of Theseus. He gathered Phaedra, hard with childhood, small, shivering in arm and breast, into his arms. He knew his age at last. Sin with this child was sin in solitude. Arms that had bound the Heraclean bull, Phaea the sow, that had fought side by side with Heracles and beat their black way from the ice of Lethe, were hard with realized identity beyond her comprehension, and he lay whole in the salty toughness of his age. When he set foot in Attica, he found Aegeus at rest, and he assumed the state. Here were abstractions fitter for his years, the calculation of corruption, thus to balance evil against evil surely, and establish immitigable good. He ruled hard in his He ruled hard in his certitude through Phaedra's death, the betrayal of his son, that eccentricity of furious children. And he gathered up the knowledge of his youth, the steady shame of tall Hippolyta, the calm of Aethra, the quiet evil of the grave Medea, the image of Pirithous in hell, caught in the moving flesh among the shades, passion immovable, the Orphic music that swelled the measure of the Argo's oars to a golden stride coeval with the sun, gathered them slowly up and fed upon them, distilled from them the honey of calm wisdom, the face of Ariadne dead, himself suddenly translated to another time. Alone he and the state established, exiled him into Scyros. Lycomedes, the strange face of a king, was all that stood between him and himself. And Lycomedes, the treacherous host, betrayed him to the state which had betrayed him, to which he had been betrayed by every movement of his flesh and spirit. So cast him from the rock to solitude, to the cold perfection of unending peace. This poem is called John Sutter. I was the patriarch of the shining land, of the blonde summer and metallic grain. Men vanished at the motion of my hand, and when I beckoned, they would come again. The earth grew dense with grain at my desire. The shade was deepened at the springs and streams, moving in dust that clung like pillared fire. The gathering herds grew heavy in my dreams. Across the mountains, naked from the heights, Down to the valley broken settlers came, and in my houses feasted through the nights, rebuilt their sinews, and assumed a name. In my clear rivers, my own men discerned the motive for the ruin and the crime, gold heavier than earth, a wealth unearned, loot for two decades from the heart of time. Metal, intrinsic value, deep and dense, preanimate, inimitable, still, real but an evil with no human sense, dispersed the mind to concentrate the will. Grained by alchemic change, the humankind turned from themselves to rivers and to rocks. With dynamite broke metal unrefined, measured their moods by geologic shocks. With knives they dug the metal out of stone, turned rivers back for gold through ages piled, drove knives to hearts and faced the gold alone, valley and river ruined and reviled. Reviled and ruined me, my servant slew, strangled him from the fig tree by my door. When they had done what fury bade them do, I was a cursing beggar, stripped and sore. What end impersonal, what breathless age, incontinent of quiet and of years, what calm catastrophe will yet assuage this final drought of penitential tears? The next poem I'll read is called The California Oaks. I should give you just a word of warning about a name that occurs in the second stanza, the name of Huishan. According to, legend or something, there is in China a manuscript supposedly written either by Huishan or about Huishan. Huishan was a little Chinese, apparently, who went out in a small boat off the coast of China, maybe along about the 8th or 9th century, something of that sort, got caught in the Japanese current and was carried way up around past Alaska and down the coast. And according to the manuscript, stopped at various places. And from the descriptions in the manuscript, he would have appeared to have stopped on the middle California coast, somewhere in this area. When this poem was translated into Italian a little while ago, the translator thought that Huishan was a river. And when it was translated into French at the same time, this was for perspective, the French translator thought he was some kind of an eagle. But he was actually a lost Chinese. Apparently the first civilized, or more or less civilized, man to set foot on the coast of California, if he really existed. The California oaks, spreading and low, unwatered, concentrate of years of growth that thickens, not expands, with leaves like mica, and with roots that grate upon the deep foundations of these lands. In your brown shadow, on your heavy loam, leaves shrinking to the whisper of decay, what feet have come to roam, what eyes to stay? Your motion has o'ertaken what calm hands. Quick as a sunbeam when a bird divides the lesser branches on impassive ground, Huishan the ancient for a moment glides, demure with wisdom and without a sound. Brown feet that come to meet him quick and shy move in the flesh, then browner dry to bone. The brook-like shadows lie where sun had shone. Ceaseless the dead leaves gather mound on mound. And where they gather, darkening the glade in hose and doublet, and with knotty beard, armed with the musket and the pirate's blade, stern as the silence by the savage feared. Drake and his seamen pause to view the hills, measure the future with a steady gaze. But when they go, naught fills the patient days. The bay lies empty where the vessel's cleared. The Spaniard, learning caution from the trees, building his dwelling from the native clay, took native concubines, the blood of these calming his blood, he made a longer stay. Longer, but yet recessive, for the change came on his sons and their sons to the end. For peace may yet derange and earth may bend the ambitious mind to an archaic way. Then the invasion and the soil was turned, the hidden waters drained, the valleys dried, and whether fire or purer sunlight burned, no matter. One by one the old oaks died or are dying. The archaic race, live oak, white oak, and valley oak, ere long must crumble on the place which they made strong, and in the calm they guarded now abide. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm informed that after about 30 minutes, which have just about passed, we're supposed to take a 10-minute intermission. My next poem is called Sir Gawain of the Green Knight. Reptilian green, the wrinkled throat, green as a bough of yew, the beard. He bent his head, and so I smoke. Then for a thought my vision cleared. The head dropped clean, he rose and walked. He fixed his fingers in the hair. The head was unabashed and talked. I understood what I must dare. His flesh cut down, arose and grew. He bade me wait the seasons round, and then when he had strength anew to meet him on his native ground. The year declined, and in his keep I passed in joy a thriving yule, and whether waking or in sleep, I lived in riot like a fool. He beat the woods to bring me meat, his lady like a forest vine grew in my arms, the growth was sweet, and yet what thoughtless force was mine. By practice and conviction formed with ancient stubbornness ingrained, although her body clung and swarmed, my own identity remained. Her beauty, lithe, unholy, pure, took shapes that I had never known, and had I once been insecure, had grafted laurel in my bone. And then, since I had kept the trust, had loved the lady, yet was true, the knight withheld his giant thrust and let me go with what I knew. I left the green bark and the shade where growth was rapid, thick, and still. I found a road that men had made and rested on a drying hill. Time in the garden. The spring has darkened with activity. The future gathers in vine, bush, and tree. Persimmon, walnut, loquat, fig, and grape, degrees and kinds of color, taste, and shape. These will advance in their due series, space the season like a tranquil dwelling place. And yet excitement swells me vein by vein. I long to crowd the little garden, gain its sweetness in my hand, and crush it small, and taste it in a moment, time and all. The these trees whose slow growth measures off my years. I would expand to greatness, no one hears, and I am still retarded in duress. And this is like that other restlessness, to seize the greatness not yet fairly earned, one which the tougher poets have discerned. Gascoigne, Ben Jonson, Greville, Raleigh, Dunn, poets who wrote great poems one by one and spaced by many years, each line an act through which few labor, which no men retract. This passion is the scholar's heritage, the imposition of a busy age, the passion to condense from book to book unbroken wisdom in a single look. Though we know well that when this fix the head, the mind's immortal, but the man is dead. A summer commentary. When I was young, with sharper sense, the farthest insect cry I heard could stay me. Through the trees intense, I watched the hunter and the bird. Where is the meaning that I found? Or was it but a state of mind, some old penumbra of the ground, in which to be but not to find? Now summer grasses brown with heat have crowded sweetness through the air. The very roadside dust is sweet, even the unshadowed earth is fair. The soft voice of the nesting dove, and the dove in soft erratic flight like a rapid hand within a glove, caress the silence and the light. Amid the rubble, the fallen fruit, fermenting in its rich decay, smears brandy on the trampling boot and sends it sweeter on its way. On the portrait of a scholar of the Italian Renaissance. The color, quick in fluid oil, affirms the flesh and lambent hair, and darkness in its fine recoil confesses that the mind is there. With heavy lip, with massive curls, with wisdom weighted strong and dense, the flesh is luminous as pearls, the eyes ingenuous but intense. The face is noble, but the name is one that we shall scarcely hold. This is a vision in a frame, defined and matted down with gold. Our names with his are but the leaves residual from this clear intent. Our finely grained identities are but this golden sediment. Summer noon, 1941. With visionary care, the mind imagines hell, draws fine the sound of flame, till one can scarcely tell the nature or the name, or what the thing is for. Past summer bow and cry, the sky distended bare now whispers like a shell of the increase of war. Thus will man reach an end in fear of his own will, yet moved where it may tend with mind and word grown still. The field mouse and the hare, the small snake of the garden, whose little muscles harden, whose eyes now quicken stare, though driven by the sound, too small and free to pardon, will repossess this ground. to a military rifle, 1942. The rifle in question, incidentally, was the 03, not the M1. The times come round again. The private life is small, and individual men are counted not at all. Now life is general, and the bewildered muse, thinking what she has done, confronts the daily news. Blunt emblem, you have won, with carving stock unbroke, with core of steel, with crash of mass and fading smoke. Your fire leaves little ash. Your balance on the arm points whither you intend. Your bolt is smooth with charm. When other concepts end, this concept hard and pure shapes every mind, therefore. And the time is yours, be sure, old hammer heel of war. I cannot write your praise when young men go to die, nor yet regret the ways that ended with this hour. The hour has come, and I, who alter nothing, pray that men surviving you may learn to do and say the difficult and true, true shape of death and power. Defense of Empire. The nervous light above my door towers high with blossoms. All their scent is shaken with the climbing roar of planes which thread the firmament. Young men, preoccupied, alone, learn to control the earth and air. Yet what is mine should be their own and interpenetrate their care. The perils of the immortal mind, the core of empire in a word, the worth of states grown hard to find, because true meaning is unheard. The deviation from the strength which forms our motion, and the phrase which cheapens thought, and yet at length would simulate more honest ways. This fine deceit, this perfect rift, dissociating thought from sense, I traced in quiet, and the shrift of wrath was all my recompense. Night of Battle, Europe, 1944, as regarded from a great distance. Impersonal the aim, where giant movements tend, each man appears the same, friend vanishes from friend. In the long path of lead that changes place like light, no shape of hand or head means anything tonight. Only the common will for which explosion spoke, and stiff on field and hill, the dark blood of the folk. An Ode on the Despoilers of Learning in an American University, 1947. This was our heritage, in learning's monument to study and teach the young until our days were spent. To re-embody mind in age succeeding age, that some few men might see, though mostly men were blind. To hold what men had wrung from struggle to atone for man's stupidity, in labor and alone. But now the insensate calm performers of the hour, cold with cold eye and palm, desiring trivial power, and terror struck within at their own emptiness, move in. As they move in, slow and invidious, they pause and calculate. Then, as such beings use, with long perfected hate, strike the immortal muse. What art of prose or verse should bring their light to book? What consecrated curse and pious rhetoric? Not one. We need but look, for these have come too far. They stand here coarse and lined, and permanent as stone in the final light of mind. The body politic of learning is its own inscrutable old bar. To the Holy Spirit, from a deserted graveyard in the Salinas Valley. Immeasurable haze, the desert valley spreads up golden riverbeds as if in other days. Trees rise and thin away, and past the trees, the hills, pure line and shade of dust, bear witness to our wills. We see them, for we must. Calm in deceit they stay. High noon returns the mind upon its local fact. Dry grass and sand, we find no vision to distract. Low in the summer heat, naming old graves, are stones pushed here and there, the seat of nothing, and the bones beneath are similar. Relics of lonely men, brutal and aimless, then as now irregular. These are thy fallen sons, thou whom I try to reach, thou whom the quick eye shuns, thou dost elude my speech. Yet when I go from sense and trace thee down in thought, I meet thee then intense and know thee as I ought. But thou art mind alone, and I, alas, am bound pure mind to flesh and bone, and flesh and bone to ground. These had no thought, at most dark faith and blinding earth. Where is the trammeled ghost? Was there another birth? Only one certainty beside thine unfleshed eye, beside the spectral tree, can I discern. These die. All of this stir of age, though it elude my sense, into what heritage I know not, seems to fall, quiet beyond recall, into irrelevance. A fragment. I cannot find my way to Nazareth. I have had enough of this. Thy will is death. And this unholy quiet is thy peace. Thy will be done, and let discussion cease. I will read the last poem in my collected poems, and then read one other which I've written since, and then I'll stop, and it's enough. This is called To the Moon. Goddess of poetry, maiden of icy stone with no anatomy, between us two alone your light falls thin and sure on all that I propound. Your service I have found to be no sinecure, for I must still inure my words to what I find, though it should leave me blind ere I discover how. What brings me here? Old age. Here is the written page. What is your pleasure now? The other poem, which appeared in the Hudson Review, 2.5 years ago, I'll have to recite from memory. I think I can do it. It's called At the San Francisco Airport, 1954. It's addressed to my daughter. This is the terminal. The light gives perfect vision, false and hard. The metal glitters deep and bright. Great planes are waiting in the yard. They are already in the night. And you are here beside me, small, contained, and fragile, and intent on things that I but half recall, yet going whither you are bent. I am the past, and that is all. But you and I, in part, are one. The frightened brain, the nervous will, the knowledge of what must be done, the passion to acquire the skill to face that which you dare not shun. The rain of matter upon sense destroys me momently. The score, there comes what will come. The expense is what one thought and something more. One's being and intelligence. This is the terminal, the break. Beyond this point on lines of air, you take the way that you must take, and I remain in light and stare. In light and nothing else awake. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it was very kind of you to come this evening and to sit here so patiently. I thank you all and wish you a very good evening.